From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. And here are the issues. A terrorist attack on Istanbul's Atatürk International Airport left at least 44 dead and more than 200 wounded. In the United Kingdom, on the heels of its decision to withdraw from the European Union, Home Minister Theresa May emerged as the frontrunner in the race to replace David Cameron as Prime Minister. Former London Mayor Boris Johnson, once the favorite to become Prime Minister, withdrew from the contest. And in the United States, presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump targeted China in a speech outlining his position on trade and globalization. Barbara, my first reaction when I heard about this horrible terrorist attack at the Istanbul airport was that their security couldn't have been very good.
Well, actually, their security wasn't bad, but the terrorists, the suicide bombers, basically tried to enter, couldn't get in, went back, got their rifles and shot up the first perimeter of security, then got into the next, shot some more people, and then blew themselves up. Mm-hmm. So actually, the security was better than it was at Brussels Airport.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard, though. I mean, unless, you know, where are you going to put the security perimeter?
Mm-hmm.
And wherever you put it, there's going to be a lineup of cars, of taxis, of people. You know, but clearly, they're going to have to think mm-hmm. about putting up barriers mm-hmm. all the way at the entrance to the mm-hmm. airport and not letting anybody so close. Most of those who died were Turks. Many of them were taxi drivers who were there, you know, letting off people. And I think the most tragic of all was a Tunisian doctor who had gone to pick up his son, who had gone to join the Islamic State and then decided he'd made a mistake and was going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And this Tunisian doctor had gone to Turkey to pick up his son, and he was blown up and killed. He was one of the dead.
Speaking of Islamic State, you know, that's, I think, the first reaction of everybody when there's some horrible terrorist attack like this. But it turns out that these terrorists were from Central Asia and the Caucasus.
Well, like Al-Qaeda, you know, may have had its origins in the Arab world, but has attracted a lot of disgruntled people from various Muslim areas of the world, of course, some from the United States, too. But I was checking up on this. Apparently, according to the Russians, something like 7,000 fighters have come from former Soviet areas to go to Syria and fight. Among them, 4,000 from the stans, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. And the remainder are from Muslim areas that are still within Russia, like Chechnya and Dagestan.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, one of the suicide bombers in this case was from Dagestan, and I think the others were from Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, Dagestan, Tom, is where the Boston terrorists were from, that at the, what was it, the
Boston
2014
Marathon.
Boston Marathon, where several people were killed, but many, many seriously wounded.
It was only a matter of time, Fred, before something like this happened in Turkey. And as a matter of fact, this was the fifth major terrorist bombing in Turkey in recent months. I mean, there is about a 70-mile, 90-kilometer or so common border with Syria, and the Islamic fighters have used that as kind of a way station, a super highway to come in and out of Turkey. Turns out that oftentimes when a terrorist is killed, he's got Turkish stamps in his passport. And so I think what happened is the United States has really been pressuring the Erdogan government to crack down and seal this border. The Turks have, until fairly recently, the Turks have resisted that. And now finally, I'm told, at the White House at least, that the Obama administration issued an ultimatum a few months ago, which is close the border, we're going to do it ourselves. And in fact, the U.S. has been heavily involved with troop movements backed by American special forces, not American troops, but run by special American special forces to shut down that border. I think also what may have provoked these terrorist bombers was the fact that the U.S. Air Force has a large presence at two Air Force bases in Turkey, especially Incirlik.
Mm-hmm.
And in recent months, the Turks have allowed U.S. Air Force fighters, notably the A-10 attack fighters to carry out bombing and strafing attacks against suspected terrorists in that
Islamic border. State terrorists.
Islamic mm-hmm. State mm-hmm. terrorists, that's right. And so, as I said, it was probably only a matter of time before a target as tempting as an airport was going to happen.
Well, 44 dead, more than 200 wounded. That's awfully bad.
Well, and also, Fred, I mean, I was struck by the fact that, I mean, these terrorists had some sort of training because if you look at the video from the airport, you see that the first terrorist started shooting up a section of the airport, and you have this mass migration of terrified people in the airport moving in one direction, where a second terrorist was waiting to blow himself up. Yeah. Now, that shows some, I wouldn't call it professional competence, but it does suggest these were more than just kind of three Islamic jihadists on a lark. They had some direction, mm-hmm. if not mm-hmm. literal direction. They had mm-hmm. some training of some sort.
Can I add one more thing about the fact that these guys came from former Soviet areas? This was also interesting. Apparently, Russian jihadists didn't begin to leave for Syria in significant numbers until 2014. When, because of the 2014 Olympics in Sochi, Russian security services apparently made it clear that they would kill any militants they could find. So Russia actively pushed people to leave these areas. So, I mean, I don't want to pin it all on Putin, but mm-hmm. But there was certainly the fact that Muslims in these areas are not well integrated into Russia.
Right.
We, of course, know the brutal wars in Chechnya that the Russian forces fought and so on. But apparently there was an active effort to push them out of the area mm-hmm. before the Sochi Olympics, and they went to Syria.
Well, let's turn to the European Union after Brexit, and particularly England. The at least in the United States, the economic impact has been actually pretty nil, but the political impact in England has been extraordinary. David Cameron's going to step down as prime minister, and everybody thought, it was certainly written, I'm not an expert on Conservative Party politics in England, but that Boris Johnson, who had backed the withdrawal from the European Union, twice elected as London mayor and so on, he seemed like the logical guy, is not even running, and now the Home Minister, Theresa May, Barbara, it looks like she's ahead anyway.
Yeah, well, I feel sorry for the Brits, but I mean, it's been delicious reading. I don't know if it's House of Cards or Game of Thrones or mm-hmm. or Shakespeare's Julius Caesar.
Maybe none of those.
Maybe none of those, but
maybe just a little chaos.
Boris Johnson clearly, and probably the others in the Brexit campaign, had no plan of what to do if they actually won the referendum. And so you had this spectacle of Johnson, who is a former journalist, and I use that term lightly in his case, since he was fired from his first job for making things up and spent most of his second job making things up. But he wrote an op-ed, I think it was in the Daily Telegraph.
And it was, yeah.
Where he basically said, well, you know, we'll still remain part of Britain and of course, you know, the ramifications won't be as dramatic as we had sort of promised you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll have to continue to accept certain restrictions if we want to have mm-hmm. access to the free market. Mm-hmm. And so there was this sort of collective gasp when they realized that he had no clue what a fine mess he'd put everyone into. And then the backstage plotting began, and there was his justice secretary, Michael Gove, another mm-hmm. ex-journalist, who was supposed to be supporting him, and then his wife, also a journalist, emailed him, and the email was leaked with all these doubts about whether Boris was really the right one. Anyway, to make a long story short, when Johnson was about to announce for his bid to replace David Cameron, he found that his supporter, his big supporter, mm-hmm. Gove, had stabbed him in the back and said he would mm-hmm. instead mm-hmm. run. And there are several others. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Theresa May and others. And when Johnson realized that he had almost no support within his own party, he withdrew. So it's a fine mess, as I say.
Well, it's certainly a mess in the Conservative Party. And I gather that Johnson, you cited that piece he wrote for The Telegraph, suggested or at least led people to believe that, well, maybe he's not committed to Praxis, even though he was one of the leaders for it. And I think that's what led to his downfall. Theresa May says that she's totally committed to it, even though she opposed it when it was voted on, although she was not a heavy campaigner for it, but she was against it.
Well, this just reminds me of some American movie of several years ago whose name escapes me. It may have been Dave, but about a political candidate, and I think it was Robert Redford, who, against all odds, is improbably elected president. Mm-hmm. And after he is elected, he says, what do we do now?
I mean, that was the candidate. You're right.
The candidate.
And it was Robert Redford. You're right. Yeah.
So my mind is not totally shot. But anyway,
well, they do have a prime minister. He's still in place, David Cameron.
Yeah, but now there's some feeling that he needs to not wait around till October. He needs to leave sooner. And
right.
Of course, the back and forth with Boris Johnson suggesting maybe we can have the best of the EU and get rid of the worst of it, in our view, which is open borders and immigration. That did not sit well in a meeting in Brussels of the European Union.
Right.
And then Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, is apparently taking a very hard line. I mean, she and David Cameron have always been allies, but her attitude is you can't have it both ways. You're either in or you're out, and if you're out, you're going to get out sooner rather than later. So
I'm going to take a break here, and we'll come back and discuss this more. It is a fun story to talk about, among other things, serious. But anyway, we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor, Tom DeFrank of the National Journal, and this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/archive/issuesinthenews. You know, I'm not much of a podcast listener, but it seems like podcasts are taking over journalism. Everybody.
Just as long as pod people don't.
Well, I agree with that. Yeah, maybe not pod people. Now, there was a question I was going to ask, Tom.
About Theresa May? Or?
About Theresa May, but about the incentives for the EU, which I think one of their big incentives is not to do anything particularly favorable for the British, because it might encourage other countries to have referendums that might win, and other countries would withdraw. There's been talk in France, which may be unlikely, but the Netherlands and Sweden and a number of other countries. We don't know at the moment whether that's just chatter or whether it's serious.
Well, but I think the leadership of the EU is taking it very seriously, because that could result, if there turns out to be a domino effect with this with this vote and other European Union nations get the itch, that could really create an unraveling. And that's why I think Merkel and other EU leaders are sending very tough messages to the British, saying, if you're in, you're in. If you're out, you're out. And don't look for a middle ground where you can siphon off the best of EU without being in EU.
Well, that certainly makes sense. And we'll see what's going to happen. You know, Germany, it looks like Merkel is the most important person here. And Germany has this enormous trade relationship now with Britain. I think that it exports about twice as much in value to England than the Brits send to Germany, particularly cars. So, I mean, obviously there's some incentive to preserve some sort of a serious trading relationship between Britain and these
EU
countries, mad as they may be.
Britain may have to negotiate a bunch of bilateral trade deals, you know, if it comes to that. But mentioning Merkel, you know, there's a NATO summit coming up. And, of course, Britain's still a member and so on. But it seems increasingly clear that the United States is going to be looking in a lot of ways toward Germany for leadership in Europe. Britain has been diminished by this. I mean, I think the cruelest cut of all, I was reading one of the many bitter articles about this in the British press. Because of Brexit and the vote, the British economy, which a week ago was the fifth largest in the world, is now the sixth largest in the world after France. And if you know anything about Britain, you know that must really rankle that they are now below France in terms of the size of their economy because of what happened to the pound.
The American stock market, you know, there was some fears. I have a few stocks, Tom, you do, and some fears that it would be really disastrous, but it hasn't been in the U.S. Is there a role for the United States here, Tom. There's been some writing about this, that the U.S. can play a role, because there's a worry about NATO, how this slight breakup of the EU can affect NATO, which is the defense agreement.
Well, President Obama is a staunch ally of both Chancellor Merkel and Prime Minister, or, you know, for a few more months, Prime Minister David Cameron. Mm-hmm. So he's going to be trying to figure out a way to soothe tempers, mm-hmm, on both sides of this issue, because you're right. And also, President Obama's very worried about Vladimir Putin, who, mm-hmm, clearly is, mm-hmm, licking his, mm-hmm, chops at the mess in, mm-hmm, the in the West here. Mm-hmm. Probably makes it a lot less likely for concerted action on the part of NATO to threaten Russian flanks in places like Ukraine. So Obama will try to come let us reason together. Mm-hmm. But I think this is one that the Europeans are going to have to, mm-hmm, sort out. And I think when President Obama's first remarks after the vote was, he basically said, "I'm sorry, this has happened, but we have, mm-hmm, to respect the mm-hmm, populist mm-hmm, rule."
Isn't there a lot, though, that NATO can do? They've done some things. They built a radar, a missile tracking station in Romania. They're going to do one in Poland.
And they're going to station, they're gonna station a battalion, yeah, mm-hmm, a rotating American battalion, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, near Russia, which has sent Putin crazy. So, no, there's plenty they can do. But if the stock market showed us anything, it is the world, global stock markets just cannot handle uncertainty, and mm-hmm, they just went crazy, mm-hmm, last week. And there's been a recovery, almost not entirely 100% recovery, but, mm-hmm, essentially a large recovery. But so I think Obama, in his last 5 months in office, mm-hmm, is going to try to figure out a way to, mm-hmm, get more stability to the situation.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on to Trump and trade and so on, I'm not sure that there's a firm answer now. But Barbara, so what does Brexit mean for the U.S.?
You know, it's not clear until we know the terms. I think it weakens the structure of the European Union. The United States likes the idea of having agreements with the EU leadership. It may doom another trade treaty,
which was, I think, already
TTIP, I believe it's called. Yeah,
I think it was already in trouble.
And might pass in a lame duck Congress. Mm-hmm. I think it raises some concerns. I mean, if you look at the role the EU has played in things like the Iran nuclear deal, for, mm-hmm, example, mm-hmm, the EU was the sort of nominal partner of the United States, along with Russia and China, in forging this agreement with Iran. Does that mean that Britain now does not cooperate as much with the other Europeans in terms of foreign and other national security policies? I mean, Britain, France, and Germany were also at the talks, but the overall structure was determined by the EU and by the EU's chief foreign policy person, a lady named Federica Mogherini. So I don't know what that does to these kinds of things. Of course, we have negotiations, or at least talks, going on about things like Syria. Britain needs to be involved. Britain's still an important country. It's, in terms of defense, it's second to the U.S. In its interventions in a lot of places. So I don't know. Again, that might put France in a more privileged position as a military power. Germany is not so much a military power. It's going to be confusing, and we really won't know the full impact until it happens. And that may not happen for 2 years. Remember, mm-hmm, this is just starting a negotiating,
right,
process.
Mm-hmm. Tom?
Can't add much more than that, mm-hmm, other than to say there will be, mm-hmm, more uncertainty until it all gets played out. And of course, it could take theoretically 2 years to play out. Mm-hmm. There's a 2-year period by which Britain will negotiate the terms of its departure. I suspect it won't take quite that long, but I think we're going to have months of uncertainty, and at the very least, very interesting for reporters, given all the personalities here. I must say, I'm sorry that Johnson is not going to be prime minister for one reason alone. I would have loved to have seen how the Queen reacted to his hair when he came and said, "I'm your new prime minister."
Yeah, she might give him a comb. Yeah, who knows? Well, let's turn to Donald Trump's
speech. From comb to comb over.
Yeah.
Sorry. Couldn't resist.
Donald Trump's speech regarding globalism and trade in particular. And there's nothing new that he's not a free trader, though all Americans, it seemed, no matter where they stand on trade, they all claim to be free traders. But anyway, he's not close. Yeah. But China took, he did say he wanted to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is Canada, Mexico, and the United States, and some other things. But he particularly hit at China. He had 7 steps he wanted to take. 3 of them involved China. One was, I'm going to list these here, he wanted his Treasury Secretary to label Chinese as currency manipulators. Yeah. You could make a case there. It's a question of whether you actually want to do it or not. He said, I'm going to instruct the U.S. Trade Representative to bring trade cases against China, both in this country and the WTO, the World Trade Organization. And if China does not stop its, this is the third one, if China does not stop its illegal activities, including its theft of American trade secrets, I will use every lawful presidential power to remedy these trade disputes, including the application of tariffs consistent with, he talked about a trade act. Tom, this is really strong stuff, particularly in dealing with China. Now, this is a speech by somebody who is an underdog in the race for the White House and probably couldn't do all that stuff anyway, but I haven't seen anything like that.
No, don't think a trade act, think trade war, because what he's suggesting with China would be a trade war. I kind of wonder if Mr. Trump realizes just how many hundreds of billions of dollars of U.S. Treasury bonds are held by the Chinese and what might happen if the Chinese got so irritated that they would decide to dump those bonds anyway. But the fact is, it's a very interesting development because Trump is now having brilliantly executed a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. He's now separating himself from one of the tenets of Republican orthodoxy. Basically, Republicans, for the most part, think trade is good and profitable, and more trade is even better.
Right.
And so he's basically saying, we've been getting ourselves killed on trade, and he's going to stand that on its head. Ironically, and some of the things that he wants to do are not that different from Hillary Clinton, although she doesn't want to start a trade war with China.
I think that these things that he talks about China, Barbara, are things that Republican and Democratic administrations have recognized happen, but they just don't think they rise to a level that you might precipitate a trade war.
Yeah, no, I think there have been a number of studies shown that this would be absolutely disastrous for the economy. Let's also point out in the, you know, watch what I do, not what I say category. I don't know that Trump products are made in China, but Trump products, most of his line of suits, ties, and cufflinks bear a made-in-China label, yes. Some also come from factories in Bangladesh, Mexico, and Vietnam. He has furniture for his hotels made in Turkey, and crystal is produced in Slovenia, the home of his wife, Melania. So watch what I do, not what I say. You know, he's running to the left of Hillary on trade. He's trying to be very sort of left-wing populist in some areas, and then in other areas he runs far to the right. It's a very confusing, I don't even want to call it a platform, because I don't think it's really a coherent set of ideas. It's just a bunch of catchphrases that he thinks will get him votes.
Well, if you read the speech, I read the speech. I have to say I didn't agree with much of it, but it was coherent, no question about that. It, as Tom said, it rejects, you know, the last 50 years, at least, of Republican thinking on trade.
Well, it's also this notion that he can turn back the clock. You know, you're not going to bring steel making back to Pittsburgh and the surrounding towns. In fact,
au contraire, according to Trump, look, I don't think he can either. But he said he would do that.
But in fact, Pittsburgh has moved on, and most of its jobs, it has more jobs now in healthcare. Has fabulous state-of-the-art healthcare.
It's recovered very well from the lack of steel.
Recovered very well. So the question that no one has yet figured out to address is, what do you do with the losers of globalization, the people who'd had these old manufacturing jobs and haven't been able to move on? You know, for that you need education, you need a lot of social programs that Trump doesn't talk about.
Tom, we're just about out. Do you want to say something very quickly?
One thing that was interesting is that he was, for once, was very disciplined. I mean, his aides have been trying to say, at least do one speech a week.
Well, this one is disciplined.
Disciplined, and I'm told it's a struggle every week.
Yeah. Well, then he gave another one where he said a plane from Mexico and was going to attack him. So let's not give him too much credit here.
Right.
anyway, this was a disciplined speech. That doesn't sound like one you're referring to. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining me on the show this week were Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.